So this coming week is Vayigash, but it's really a part of a story, and it's a pretty wild story where the brothers come down to Egypt, and this is the second time they're down there. This time they bring their son, their brother Binyamin, Benjamin, after Yehuda steps up to the plate and basically says to his father, "It's on me," meaning I'm taking full responsibility. In contrast to the way Reuben presented, very strange construct. Reuben seems to always be a little bit something, a little bit off there. But when Yehuda steps up to the plate, he says, "Then Judah said to his father, 'Israel, send the boy in my care, and let us be on our way, that we may live and not die, you and we and our children. I myself will be surety for him. You may hold me responsible. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, I shall stand guilty before you forever.
And who's this talking to?
This
Who,
is
like, in
Judah.
reference to who?
Judah's talking about taking Benjamin in his care,
Oh, not Joseph. Okay.
not to, but he's taking him to the unknown king, which ends up being, we end up finding out it's Joseph, but either way, for we could have been there and back twice if we had not dawdled. Okay. It's a funny word. So it's
My mother
interesting.
used to say that.
Why?
My mother used to say that to me, like,
Yeah,
so don't
okay.
dawdle.
Okay, so now, then their father Israel said to them, if it must be so, do this. Take some of the choice products of the land in your baggage and carry them down as a gift for the man, some balm and some honey gum, ladanum, pistachio nuts, and almonds." So it's kind of a funny thing. Basically, what he's saying to him is it's not about money. Bring him a gift, because he's starting to sense that this person, whoever this is not concerned about money. As a matter of fact, every time they came, he sent them back with their money, you know? So it's not about the money. "And take with you double the money, carrying back with you the money and that was replaced in the mouths of your bags. Perhaps it was a mistake. Take your brother too and go back at once to the man. And may El Shaddai dispose the man to mercy toward you, that he may release to you your other brother as well as Benjamin. As for me, if I am to be bereaved, I shall be bereaved." So here it's interesting is that he uses the name Israel. Now Yaakov, Jacob, Israel, it keeps on going back and forth. Where every time the
I
name
know, I know it's confusing,
okay,
but
so what's going so every time you see the name Israel, Yisrael, it means that this is Jacob on in the realm of the spiritual, and also representing the greater Jewish soul, the greater Jewish collective soul. It's like he's actually elevated here. He's now in this higher plane. Everything he's saying seeks out a different type of dimension. But what's interesting here is that Judah steps up to the plate. And what you see basically is that he in this next parasha of Vayigash also he steps up. He really like becomes the leader of the Jewish people, the king. He takes on royalty in these couple of parasha. One first is when he admits to having messed up with Tamar. He takes responsibility. Every time the one of the traits of a Jewish king is the ability to take responsibility, and when you make a mistake, "I was wrong, I'm responsible." Judah has that special quality that is one of the major factors or building blocks that's necessary in the fallible Jewish king. A Jewish king that can not just that he's fallible, but that he's able to step up and admit that he makes mistakes and do tshuva and repent. And that's really the mark of greatness. And that's a model for us. Fine. So they get down to Egypt and they stand, and there they presented themselves to Joseph. When Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to his house steward, "Take the men into the house, slaughter and prepare an animal, for the men will dine with me at noon." The man did as Joseph said. Vayas Ha'ish, who's this man? So this mysterious man is none other than this is one of Joseph's sons. And he brought the men, Yaveha Ishat Hanashim. The man brought the men into Joseph's house. Vayiru Hanashim, Kihuvu Beit Yosef. But the men were frightened of being brought into Joseph's house. It must be, they thought, because of the money replaced in our bags the first time that we have been brought inside as a pretext to attack us and seize us as slaves with our pack animals. So that it's funny that they're worried about Et Chamarino. It's kind of a funny thing, but they're worried about he's going to take us as slaves and he's going to take our animals. So it's just kind of a funny, I think that's like a funny thing. But okay, either way. So they went up to Joseph's house steward and spoke to him at the entrance to the house. And they said, "If you please, my lord," they said, "we came down once before to procure food. And Vayihiki Banu El Malon," so they said, "when we arrived that night to the motel, Niftchah at Amtchotenu, and we opened up our bags, and there was and Vehine Kesef Ish Bifi Amtachto, Kaspinu Bemishkalo, Benashavoto, Beyadenu. There was each one's money in the mouth of his bag. Our money is full. So we have brought it back with us." So the little problem here that goes on in this, which is a remarkable thing, which is a whole nother discussion, is that that's not what happened. When they went to the hotel, it was Levi, or one of the brothers, that opened his bag and found the money on top of his bag. But then none of the other ones found money in their bag. Later on, when they got home, they found the money was on the bottom of the bag. And so what was going on here is that, so Joseph's like sending a lot of different messages, because what you have is, you have a scenario where he's taking Shimon and Levi, and he's kind of singling them out because Levi and Shimon are the brothers that led the charge back in the story of Shechem, when Dina, their sister, was taken captive, and they're proposed to do a merger of sorts with the place called Shechem, and they do this very kind of underhanded thing where they say, "Hey, have a bris, do a circumcision," and on the third day after these people complied, they went and they killed everybody. Now their claim was, "Hey, the guy defiled their sister, made her into a harlot, into a prostitute." So they felt justified. And the truth is, it's left in a very kind of like, this is complicated type of thing. Whereas Jacob was like, on one hand you're right, but on the other hand you just put us in a lot of danger with the people surrounding, because you just slaughtered an entire group of people. So it was very. But we see that Levi and Shimon are these two brothers that kind of work together, and unfortunately when they work together can sometimes have a bad outcome. So Joseph does is he takes Shimon, he's the one that he takes and puts into the jail, sends the other brothers away, "Bring me back Benjamin." And then when they leave, he puts extra money into Levi's bag. So now they go crazy when that happens. And they're like, "Oh gosh, what do we do? This is it. We're going." But they don't put two and two together that Shimon and Levi are the ones who are being singled out. So Joseph's like having fun, not fun, but he's like kind of messaging, but they're not picking up on these subtle messages. But the way they remember the story is not how it happened. They said, and they tell it, they say it over as if this is what happened, when it's not the case. The case was that only Levi had the money on the top. And only he, as it's recorded earlier, is the one who discovers the money. But when they tell over the story here, they say there was each one's money in the mouth of his bag, our money in full. That's not what happened. But they reconstruct it that way so that they believe that to be the case. And so, meaning again, they did get the money, but it was not discovered at this motel. And we have, okay, so they bring this in. They claim this story, which is just, there's a lot of interesting with in this entire story, the way people see things and experience things is very interesting. There's a subjective slant that colors them. And again, the question really is how different did Joseph look? True that he was away and he left when he was very young, but he recognized them right away. They don't recognize him. And a lot of it had to do with the fact that they couldn't see what was right in front of their eyes. And so a lot of the drama, the background, story that's going on here is that you have this, that you see that they're working through this, and they definitely have the guilt of having sold their brother or having watched him suffer when they let him go. So there's part of that, there's that at play. But at the same time, they never take it to the next step of wanting to see or able to see Joseph, who's right in front of their eyes. And like one of the things that this famous Beis Halevi, just I'm jumping here just to show you this craziness, that when you get to the parasha, and this week's parasha, when he reveals himself to his brothers, and you know Judah has this very passionate plea, and he basically, his speech, when he goes into Joseph's face, makes Joseph break down. And that's where he can't hold on anymore. Okay?
So in your brother.
Okay? And what the crazy thing is, if you look at here, when they got there, so let's jump here. Okay. So when they got there, this is initially when they're at the, when they come back now with Benjamin. So he asks them. Okay, so he asks them. He says, he's looking about. Where is it? Okay, yeah, here. He says to them. He greeted them, and he said, "How is your aged father of whom you spoke? Is he still in good health?" They replied, "What?"
Who's speaking?
This is, so Joseph asked them.
Joseph asked.
Because it says like this, when Joseph, I skipped, and then, but let me hear. So when Joseph came home, they presented to him the gifts that they had brought him with them. Then he greeted them, and he says to them, how is your aged father whom you spoke? They replied, "It is well with your servant, our father. He is still in good health." Okay? Now watch this. Then this, I'm giving you a quick, you know, summary of the story, is that he sends them away with their money again. This time, though, he plants the cup in Benjamin's bag. Then sends them out and arrests them. And says, "How dare you? You here after all this goodness that I've done for you, you stole from me?" And he takes them and he says, "Okay, I'm going to just take Benjamin. He'll be my slave." And then this is where Judah steps up to the plate and he says, "Absolutely not. Basically over my dead body." Judah went up to him and said, "Please, my lord, let your servant appeal to my lord and do not be impatient with your servant, you who are equal with Pharaoh. My lord asked his servants, have you a father or another brother? We told my lord, we have an old father, and there is a child of his old age, the youngest. His full brother is dead, so that he alone is left of his mother, and his father dotes on him. Then you said to your servants, bring him down to me, etc." So this whole, he gives this whole speech. At a certain point, Joseph loses it, okay? And it says Joseph can no longer control himself before all of his attendants, and he cried out, "Have everyone withdraw from me." So there's no one else about when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. His sobs were so loud that the Egyptians could hear, and so the news reached Pharaoh's palace. Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still well?" So now check this out. Now, if you read this out of context, you would say, oh, he just wants to know. So first says, "I'm Joseph. Is dad still okay?" Okay, but that's not what he's really saying, because he already knows, because I showed you, he already had asked them, is your father still alive? They said, yes, he's well. They have not gone back. They have not been back. All they did was they left his place. He arrested them because they stole the cup. He brings them back in. So they have yet to go. They have not gone back up to Israel, to the land of Israel. So there's nothing, there's no new news here, so to speak. So when he says to them, "Is my father still well?" it's not a normal question. Actually, it's rhetorical.
Yes, he knows the answer. Yes.
He knows. So what he's doing is he's actually, it's kind of a jab. He's saying, "I'm Joseph. Is our father still well? Because you just gave me this whole thing that what Judah gave him a whole speech about what's going to be if you don't let Benjamin go back, then our father is going to die or it's going to be horrible pain." And he's saying to them, "That's interesting. You didn't think about that when you sold me, right?" So the Beis Halevi, he says that this is actually Joseph's very harsh rhetorical question to them: "Is my father still well?" And so, but his brothers could not answer him. So dumbfounded were they on account of him. So perhaps that's why they're so dumbfounded. First, they're shocked because here you have it. He's basically been in front of their eyes the whole time. They could not see it. And here he says to them, you're giving me this whole story. And if we go back just to see that Judah's whole plea is that if I don't take this him back, then my father is going to be, you know, it's going to be horrible for our father. Right? And so part of it is that he says, there is part of the speech that he talks about his own responsibility, which again was the greatness of Judah. But he's really sticking it to them in a way by saying it, you know, now you're worried about our father. The last 22 years, our father has been in, you know, suffering, and you never, you know, you didn't think about that when you let me be sold, or you sold me. It's a question of whether you were sold or kidnapped or whatever. They had the idea. Maybe it wasn't that they did it, but either way, they watched him go and they didn't stop it. At that point, so but it's amazing here. He says, come forward to me. And they came forward, he said, I'm your brother, Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. Okay, so
yeah.
So the first step is, I'm Joseph, is our father still alive? That's kind of like a real hard jab. But then he says, I am Joseph, I am your brother, Joseph.
Yeah.
Which is different than the first thing he said. He says to them, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? Isn't that interesting? Is my father, is Ha'od Avichai, is my father, not your father, is my father, okay? Then when he says, I come here, I am Joseph, Achichem, your brother.
Achichem.
Okay, I'm now, it's like, it's a different, so like you have, he says, on one hand, I'm Joseph, is my father still well or alive? And the second thing he says to them, I am Joseph, your brother. So there's already a change, who you sold to Egypt. Again, you know, it's like, I am your brother, but also you're the one, you know, so like there's that sold me to Egypt type of thing, okay? But he says, now, do not be distressed or reproach yourselves because you sold me hither. It was to save life that God sent me ahead of you. It's for sustenance that I was sent by God in front of you, right? So he says to them, I'm not holding you responsible. God, this is God's will. So you see this incredible, like the, you know, if you don't understand, like this, you know, if I went through a, you know, darkness and difficulty, like a Joseph, like how is it that he's able to keep himself so, you know, positive? Or you know, here it is, these are the guys who sold him down and were horrible to him. And he's able to say to them, you know, it's not, don't feel bad. It wasn't, you know, at the end of the day, this is God's will. He sent me here for this purpose, to be able to take care of the family.
He gives them a break.
Right? And again, also, he says, God has sent me ahead of you to ensure your survival on earth and to save your lives in an extraordinary deliverance. Hmm. Right? So it was not you who sent me here, but God.
God.
And he has made me a father to Pharaoh, lord of all of his household, and ruler over the whole land of Egypt. So now hurry back to my father and say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to be to me without delay. The way he's translating, like here he could have said, you guys, you know, messed me over. I want to,
yeah,
you know, you're going to be in jail for the rest of your lives. That's not what it is. He sees this as clearly the hand of God. And that's really Joseph's whole world. Like if you watch and track him, he's always attributing everything to God. He sees that as, and the shame Elohim, he always, the reference of Joseph to God is Elohim. Elohim. And that is, when we refer to God, there's so many different names that we would refer to Hashem. One of them is Elohim, is that we go back to the name of God in creation. So this is a very, you know, God as seen, like as we can look in nature and see the hand of God. So that's Joseph. Like Yosef sees, clearly, like he clearly has that viewpoint. His glasses are, everything that happens is from God. It's interesting. There's a Gemara that talks about the idea of being worried of the evil eye, or like being seen in a way that would, you know, be, you know, bring bad energy to you, let's say. And the people that are there comment and they say, I'm not worried about that. I'm from the offspring of Joseph. Like they come from the school of thought of Joseph, which is that if you're so tied in that you can be out there as Joseph was, this public figure, and not be worried about any type of negativity coming his way, because he understands, he's so keyed in and tied in to the that God is running the show, that for him it's like, I understand, you might think that you guys did this to me, but that's not, you're just a vehicle, and this was the will of God, right? And so therefore, you know, that, you know, watching this play out, he's like, okay, I you know, here, he might not have, it's interesting, would he have been able to say this, whoa, would he have been able to say this would he be able to have said this at maybe at the beginning of this, the whole episode, as he went down to Egypt, when he went to the house of Potiphar, when he goes into jail, you know, back and forth, all this stuff, I don't know. But
exactly. Is he able to say it now because it worked out okay?
Well, that's interesting. So no, so he clearly, wait, so no, so there, so it's like this. In for sure we see numerous times that even at the beginning stages that he attributes, and that everybody sees within him a person that really devoutly believes in God and that God is blessing him. He's blessed, and that he has this incredible faith. What's interesting, by the way, if you take a step back and you notice that multiple times Joseph shows up and he's like given the keys to the castle, so to speak. So first he gets down to Egypt, and the head of the house,
he interprets the dreams.
Right, no, but it's not just that. He's first put in the house of Potiphar, and he's basically made in charge of that house. Then he gets thrown in jail, and the guy in the jail makes him like basically in charge of that. And then here he gets pulled out of the dungeon, so to speak. And then what happens? Pharaoh literally on day one meets him, and right away makes him number two, and has control over everything in Egypt. That's pretty unbelievable. So I was talking to my friend. He said, because Joseph is very charismatic. I said, no. You have charismatic people, but they're not necessarily people that you can be very charismatic. Doesn't mean that you're going to create that trust in people. That right when you meet the person, you feel, wow, I trust this guy without even thinking twice about it. There's something about Joseph that it was so sincere and so, you know, trustworthy, that he gave some, that there was an energy about him that when you met him, you just right away said, I can trust this guy. There's nothing I can worry about. He had that quality, which is an amazing thing. And so you see that he has...
Would he have been so thrilled that if it had not worked out, that he's down on his luck, that it's still God's wish?
Yeah, so that's the whole point. So that's the whole point, is that God's wish and what God is, how God is sending us, is that, you know, like they have the story with Rabbi Akiva, who's Akiva ben Yosef, which is like the famous story. He goes to a town and he gets over late. He has a camel, and he has a chicken, and he has a candle. And he goes and he cannot find any hotel rooms. So he's forced to sleep outside the town that night. And he's out there in the field, and a wind comes and blows out his candle, and then his camel, like everything, like you can't, everything that could go bad goes bad. Everything, his camel dies, and everything is, he's got nothing. And he goes to sleep, wakes up the next morning, and the town had been completely destroyed that night by an army that came through. And so here he says, when the candle went out, what did he think? Oh, this, I mean, I'm going to be in the dark now. I can't. Then when, like, I just lost my major possession, my camel, or, you know, like whatever, or the rooster, whatever it was that, you know. So here he, in those moments, he said, no, everything that God does for the best, I just don't understand yet. So the idea of, like, so now we're looking at the story and saying, the outcome was great, so big deal. But the point is now that Joseph actually, the whole way through, it appears that he's actually keyed in, and the reason he got here is because of that incredible connection and faith that he had, that he's always able to bounce back. I mean, think about it. Today, you know, in our day and age, everybody, you know, you get a curveball and all of a sudden you break down and you want to jump off, God forbid, you know, from, you know, a high floor. So like here, right? That's not what's happening here. So it's just it's a very interesting now. Just as a side, the idea of like the back and forth between Judah and Joseph is that really this is like the construct for the further in the future of the Jewish people is this external person, the Joseph, the one who's going out to the world, and the Judah, which is more the insular, and that we have this idea of two messiahs, this messiah of Joseph and messiah of Ben David, of King David, which is coming from Judah, and that they really are like there's this person that needs to, or a movement of people that are going to be more out to the outside world, and then there's going to be the ultimate like king and the messiah that's going to be coming from King David from Judah, that's going to be more of this insular, internal type of personality, you know, that's setting up shop. We'll see later that Jacob sends Judah to set up the infrastructure for the family when they're going to be down in Egypt so that they can thrive in Egypt in that setting. But the idea is that you have both of these things, these forces of a Judah and a Joseph that are going to play out into the future in time, that all the way till our day and age, like some people like to understand that the first wave of like Zionism and you know the state of Israel is much more of a Joseph type of you know type of approach, and that you're going to have and then you're going to have this a Judah you know King David you know ultimately more of this insular you know more of the leader that's going to come from within that's going to help you know and that the truth is that they really need to come together. There's a prophecy that talks about the two actually like two like the symbolism of two pieces of wood that'll become joined together and they'll be one. So this idea of like you see here, and it's obviously we're just touching the you know doing this very quickly just to get you know but the idea is that you see here that first there's something going on with the brothers that they did not they had a hard time being able to see what was right in front of their eyes and that they were you know, how they remembered a certain event was not exactly how it happened. It's interesting about human psychology that we can actually remember things a certain way that actually didn't happen the way because we wanted it to be that we wanted it to happen the way
Exactly,
right. So you have that kind of thing in human nature. You have this incredible power of Judah and his ability to step up to the plate and to take responsibility, and you have also this incredible quality of Joseph of how he's able to stay sto it's like really be able to stay above the fray and then to see. After going through all these things, that it was always manufactured, and the hand of Hashem was really that which was running the show, and it played out in the way that it played out for this reason. So yeah, and really, if you think about it, it goes back to his original dreams. His original dreams was that he was going to be the provider for the family. That's what it meant when they had the sheaves of grain bowing down to his sheaf of grain, was that he was going to be, they said, HaMeloch Timloch Alein, are you going to be our king? Which means, are you going to be our provider? And the answer ultimately was that, yeah, that's what exactly his dreams came to be. They came to play out. And that what really was the issue what they had originally with him was that it was very personal and very egocentric. But as they see here, there's no ego here. This is not, he's saying, it's not me. This is what God wanted. And I don't take what you did to me personally because I understand it's not, it's a much bigger, the story's much bigger than an individual. So,
That's quite an extraordinary response.
So you see the greatness of these are, this is why when we say that, that ultimately Jacob's bed was whole, that he had 12 holy, righteous sons, is because we get to see them develop in front of our eyes. So it's not a static type of thing, but rather this developmental. And when you read the parsha of Vayigash and you can like look closely at how Judah speaks and presents, which I didn't go into today, but it's worthwhile looking at, and then how you see that how Joseph also like it's incredible. I mean, each of the brothers, they really have this. They have tremendous depth to them, and we just get to see them more exposed. So like they, you know, we could see some of their frailties, but the truth is, we also get to see them develop into these amazing people, which becomes you know our guiding you know guiding light for all of our history and for the, you know for our current you know situation that we're in. And then to tie it, I guess to tie it into to Hanukkah, I guess somehow, that they say that this idea of Joseph, also, you know, this. So the idea of this, how does this play into the Hanukkah story? So, when we refer the very the, if you look through the Torah or actually even the Chazal, there's very few people that are referred to as a tzaddik, a righteous one. They have different, you know, like Moshe. Moses is Rabbeinu, he's our teacher. We don't call Moses our tzaddik. He's not our righteous one. The one that's referred to as the tzaddik is Yosef, is Joseph, okay? Even though it's interesting, Noah also has that. The Torah calls Noah Ish Tzaddik Tamim Hayah B'dor Asav. He's called a tzaddik also, whatever that means. But for our purposes, Joseph is called a tzaddik. And so what's interesting is that Yavon, which is Greece, right? And so Jerusalem is called Tzion, Zion, right? Zionism, Zion. So it's Jerusalem, Zion. It could be, you know, the whole Israel, but like the idea of Zion. So Zion, Tzion, is the idea of Tzaddik Yavon. Now, what does that mean? So Yavon, Greece, is associated with the idea, and they celebrated beauty, external beauty. It says at the beginning of Noah's three sons, he says, Yaft Elokim Yefet, v'yishkon ba'alei shem. God gave Yefet, who's the progenitor of Greece, beauty. Yaft Elokim Yefet, and that ultimately they'll dwell in the tents of Shem, who is the progenitor of Israel. So there's this idea that Greece, when they entered in, they glorified beauty, the beauty of the human being, the human body, right? Alana was telling me she did all this research on when the Greeks, when they played sport, right? They actually played, everything was naked. Because they celebrated the beauty of the body, so much so that that's why the idea of circumcision was something that they attacked, because they said, "How can you mutilate the body in its perfection of it? The way you're born is perfect," and that's the
it's
most
true. They're not wrong.
Okay. Well, that's the interesting thing, is that we're saying the body is, you know, God's creation is beautiful and perfect, but God said with that, at the same time, you're supposed to take the creation and then go with it and do things with it. The idea of the circumcision is to take this thing, and now I want you to actually do things with it, not just to leave it as a static, right?
Right.
Okay.
Interesting concept.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a whole nother. So it comes along, and if the whole idea is beauty, the beauty of Greece. So it actually threw a curveball at the Jewish people, because this culture came in that they had not been exposed to, that was really on a high level, and it threw them for a curve. What's interesting about Joseph, when we look at the Torah, the one person that's described, there are really two people that are described as beautiful. Yifat Torah and Yifat Mara have a beauty to them.
Joseph, right, very handsome, right?
Right, Joseph and his mother. We meet Rachel, she's referred to as the beautiful one. And so too, he also has the same description. So it's Joseph and his beauty. He actually, his the way he takes that and I would say it like how he is able to integrate it is the way that it counters Greece. Because if Greece is really coming and challenging to the extent where they want to remove God from the equation, so comes along Joseph, who has beauty, but also has this very deep connection with God and sees the hand of God in everything. So it very much goes counter to what the Greeks had brought to the, you know, to the table. What I saw like this week, or I guess about a week or two, is this idea that also Abraham, Avraham Avinu, the first of this whole thing, the one who discovered God, he has a connection to Hanukkah also. So how so? So the tradition says that he was born Rosh Chodesh Tevet, this month that we just started. It's connected to, it's right smack in the middle of Hanukkah, right? So the way this the Bas Ayin explains that the purpose of creation, initially, when you read the Torah, is that Adam, There's the first, second, third, fourth, fifth days of creation, and then on the sixth day, the point of all of creation is Adam. He's the purpose of creation. It's when Adam comes to the scene that the whole creation comes together. So therefore, you see that the model for preparing for the point of creation is the five-day process. 5 days lead up to, we celebrate the creation of Adam as Rosh Hashanah. That means that on the 25th of Elul is when God started creating the world. He says, let there be light. And then 5 days later, on the first day of Tishrei, which is Rosh Hashanah, that's when Adam is born. We celebrate Rosh Hashanah because that's the point of all of creation. The whole year starts because of that event. He's the center, the locus, the point of...
Adam was discovered, it wasn't there on the first day.
Right, exactly. Right? It's not till the sixth day. So the point of all those 5 days is to prep for the sixth. So if that's the model, it says later on, that after Adam sins, then who comes along to rectify the sin? Abraham. Abraham takes over the mantle. He becomes the focal point of creation because really what he does is he comes along and he actually gets it right, because the whole point of this thing is for us to recognize that God created the world and he's involved in this world. So Abraham's the first one really to come and say, there's not multiple gods, there's not multiple, you know, breaking it down into like different, powers, but rather just one power. So 5 days prior to his birth would be the beginning of Hanukkah. Like that? So now, right? So now what's interesting is that the law, the way we set up, when are you supposed to light the candles of Hanukkah? It says from sunset until the people leave the marketplace. So like as long as there are people out and about, so you light candles. Why? Because we want people to see the candles in the window or out wherever, however, in Jerusalem, I put them outside on the stoop. It's actually my candles are, my menorah is outside. It's pretty cool. You see that a lot in Jerusalem. It's amazing. But the idea is that people should see and they should, you know, recognize this miracle. So now, when is the earliest you can do it? It's from when the sun sets. So the Bas Ayin says something beautiful. He says, you know, that really goes back to Abraham. Because when did Abraham recognize or begin to like recognize God? They say at the age of 3, whatever that means. Maybe he recognized God at the age of 52, 40, they're different ages, okay? But it's from Mitishka Achama, from the time that the sun set. Why? What is the significance of that? So Abraham lived in a time when pretty much the go-to idol or power that was worshipped was the sun.
Oh, right.
Okay, so check this out. Here he is. He's looking at, he's like, okay, the sun. It's pretty powerful. Can't look at it. It blinds my eyes. That's pretty powerful.
Yeah.
But then he sees the sun sets. He says, how can it be that the sun, which is God, or that we're attributing all this power to this sun, and then it sets and disappears, can't be that that's God. There's got to be something greater. So now you have, if Abraham's at the core, underlined, there's like an Abraham type of theme at the bottom here, at this like at the level zero, that underlies this whole thing of the person who like discovered God. When did he discover God? At sunset. So when do we light the candles, the menorah? At sunset. That's the earliest time. It goes like this connection, very deep connection back to the idea, so that it's discovering God and in integration, taking the beauty of Joseph, encountering it from the idea of the Greeks that said it's just man. It's all about what we, man, can recognize, nothing else. And then Joseph saying, no, it's the power of God of creation that's powering all of this. And that beauty is not a bad thing when it's when you integrate it into, you know, bringing, worshiping it to God, worshiping God. And that's why it's interesting the way we talk about the idea of a mitzvah and making it beautiful. It's because we want to take that beauty and integrate it into the worship of God, right? So it's like we should have a nice sanctuary. We should have a nice menorah. We should have a nice esrog and lulav. We should have a nice, you know, it goes down the list of when we do a mitzvah, we should have a nice tefillin, you know? So it's zekeli vanvei, we should be mahader, we should bring beauty to the mitzvahs and how we worship God. So it's Joseph who integrates, and that's Sion. So the idea of Zion is Tzaddik Yavon. It's the idea of the righteous and taking that beauty of Greece and bringing it, elevating it to that high, to the which is what the righteous person can do. You can meet people that are just like, especially like walking around Jerusalem, you walk around and there are people that are just amazing, that are just you know, there's something like they're on a different level. So that's the idea of a tzaddik, a righteous person that can elevate this world and, you know, really take it to a high level and really, you know, elevate things to that very, very special place. So that's I think, you know, this idea of the Joseph Judah story and how it plays out for our history, but also how it integrates Joseph especially into the story of Hanukkah and to the Greeks, and you know, there's a lot that's going on there. Any questions or comments?
No. It's a lot of stuff to take into, but no, it's great. It was great. No, I was just reading up about, sort of a separate aside, I was reading that book by Tovia Singer about Let's Get Biblical.
Okay.
And so he described, first of all, this Christianity stuff is a bunch of nonsense. Unbelievable. Like, that guy Paul just totally screwed him over and like rejected the whole thing. I mean, you're talking about how through the oral law, the exact number of days down to the seconds of the lunar month is 29.50. Like, that was known to the Jews before even NASA could calculate that.
Right. Yeah. It's a crazy. They call it the Sod HaIbur. The secret of the how they come up with this,
they need the calendar to come out so that Passover is always in the spring on the 15th of Nisan, right?
Well, it has to be right, but it has to be in the spring. Meaning, the way that you have to have the solar calendar jive with the lunar calendar, so it's not a pure lunar calendar. That's why you can say, like, Islam will take the lunar calendar exclusively. So Ramadan's always moving.
But it's always a different time.
But the way we have it, because it says, It's the holiday of the spring. That's what Passover is referred to as Chag Aviv. So it has to be in the spring. So how do you do that? You have to make up for that, the differential between, I think it's 11 days. Not exact. It's like whatever the number is, 9 days, 11, whatever. So that differential always has to be worked out. And it's a 19-year cycle, and it has different leap years. This year is a leap year where we add a full month, Adar. So we have Adar Rishon, Adar Sheni. So this is where it corrects itself. So next year you'll have, you know, things will come later. You know, they'll be late next year.
But that number was known.
Correct. So they knew. So like there are things that you find, let's say in Kabbalistic, you know, writings also, where you'll find things that are, let's say, related to, let's say, there's physics, there's, you know, things that would, you know, let's say like Einstein's types of, you know, revelations that they say you can, that you could, you possibly could find in early writings in the Zohar.
So, but the idea was passed down through the oral law. This 29.5 days was passed down.
Yeah, but it's not exactly 29.5. It's like, you know, it's like down to like.
But it got out to four digits. It was like.
If you go to a shul, like they'll announce the molad will be, which means the sighting of the new moon, will be on, you know, a certain time. And it'll be down to like, I mean, they go down to like, I mean, it's not even called minutes. It's like halakim and, I don't know, it's like this.
Oh, halakim, yeah, 100 is like 10,080 halakim per hour. So each one is about 3.5 seconds.
Right, so they get down to the second, yeah, exactly.
So that was amazing to me.
That is very, that's interesting.
Yeah, so now I've been trying to do my tefillin every morning now.